You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at the state of climate change as 2016 comes to a close.
First, when was the last time you found yourself staring at the little triangle on the bottom of a plastic container to figure out how to recycle it? Well, it may come as a surprise that the system of numbers, which is today a global recycling standard, originated right here in Wisconsin.
In her children's book, our guest Elise Moser tells the story of Wisconsinite Millie Zanto, who kickstarted plastic recycling in the 70s after noticing tons of reusable garbage dumped into the overflowing landfill in her town, Sauk City.
Writer Elise Moser joins us now. Her book is What Millie Did, the Remarkable Pioneer of Plastics Recycling. Elise, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, this is not someone that I had ever heard of and a story I'd never heard before. How did you find out about her?
I found out about her kind of by accident. I went to an Environmental Information Day in Sauk City, and somebody mentioned that the woman who invented the recycling symbol was from Sauk City. In fact, she, as you said, invented the system of numbers inside the triangle, but close enough. And I was kind of new to the area, and I thought, well, everyone must know this. I just don't know because I'm the new girl. But when I asked around, I found out that nobody knew, and I thought everybody should know.
And so you've told her story in a children's book. Why a children's book in particular?
Because my first thought really was kids should know a woman did this. I was surprised. First of all, it never occurred to me somebody had to invent that because I just never thought about it. But then I thought, you know, women's accomplishments are often not as visible as they should be, and especially in the area of science, technology. And this was a big thing. I thought boys and girls should grow up knowing women do these things.
And it sounds as though she got the little first germ of an idea on a trip to Japan. You write in the book that she was there as a volunteer sort of ambassador for the International Crane Foundation, which in itself sounds like a cool story. But what did she see in Japan?
She stepped out of the place where she was staying every morning, and there were little bundles on the curb. And every day the bundles were different. And she started to realize day after day that what she was seeing was little bundles of recyclable materials, but separated by type. And that's when she realized that it was recycling, and it made an impression on her.
So she started working on a project to recycle and come up with a system. And at some point along, of course, she had to buy an industrial grinder. Now, here's Millie. Here's her voice in a 2012 interview describing picking up this giant grinder from a factory in Chicago.
They just died laughing when they saw us. That made their day. Loading that plastic grinder in the back of the truck, it's weighed a ton. We were both so busy. When we got into it, we went all the way. I mean, we did everything.
That was 6 days a week.
Right. And then if we had a good March wind, it was 7 days a week because I chased the stuff all the way up the highway as it blew away.
Incredible story there about purchasing that first grinder. Sounds like people were laughing at Millie and her friend. And it's a funny story, but it's also remarkable because there was a lot of sacrifice involved in what they did to get that grinder.
Yes.
What happened?
They needed $5,000 and they didn't have it. So Millie convinced her friend, who you heard in that clip, Jenny Ale, who still lives in now Prairie du Sac. They cashed in their life insurance policies to get the money. Millie later said, well, we knew we didn't need the money. We didn't need the life insurance right away, but we needed the money right away. And so they cashed it in.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Millie Zanto from Wisconsin, from Sauk City, and her pioneering efforts in plastics recycling here in the United States. We're talking to Elise Moser, who has a new book out about her, a children's book. And you got to meet Millie before she passed away, but not very long before she passed away.
Nope. It was a real amazing fluke. I went I had been looking for her and I couldn't find her, because I realized later that people kind of disappear when they go into a nursing home. There are no traces anymore out in the world. And I found her by accident. I was going to visit another friend, and she was there, and I knocked on her door and introduced myself, and I said, "Can I come back one day and interview you?" And she said, "Well, why don't we just do it right now?" And I found out later that her illness was advancing, and that may have been her last lucid day.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And did she, at that point, have a sense of sort of the history and the magnitude of what she'd done, what she'd created?
I think she did. For a long time after she stopped being actively involved in the recycling business, she was invited to come visit communities all over the United States and much further afield, China, Mexico, to help other people set up their recycling systems. So she knew that what she had done had triggered the worldwide capacity to recycle plastics.
I think now we think of recycling, oh, it's just one of those household chores. It's like taking out the garbage or doing the dishes. Can you talk about, there's the numbers and the other things that she did, that she created, that are now just part of the background routine for us now?
Well, the main thing is the system of numbers. They're called resin codes. And so when we think of plastic, we think of it as if it's just one thing. We only have the one word for it in the vernacular. But in fact, plastics are many different kinds of things. Chemically, they're different from each other, and you can't melt them together, which was why nobody had been recycling plastics before Millie figured out an easy way to separate them. And so it's that system of numbers. I mean, Millie figured out an entire system. She figured out it has to be sustainable from a financial point of view. She convinced somebody to figure out how to manufacture things out of the recycled plastic. She figured out how to make the system work from one end to the other. But it was the numbers, the system of resin codes that made it possible globally.
And she also discovered that you couldn't create things like this, start a movement in a vacuum. It sounds like she partnered with schools and local businesses and got everybody sort of on board and tried not to step on toes. What was her relationship with the community like?
Well, this whole thing happened because she was so connected to her community, and she really activated the community around her to be engaged with this. When she first started, she knew she wanted to collect not only plastics, but also paper and aluminum. But she knew that there were Boy Scouts in Sauk City who were collecting newspapers for recycling, and so they would not collect newspapers in places where they were in competition with the kids. There were kids also who were collecting aluminum, and they collected enough to buy a microscope for their school. So Millie was careful. She was more interested in making the whole idea work than in succeeding in having, you know, the most.
And Millie passed away a couple years ago. You shared with us a picture you took of a bench that's in downtown Sauk City that commemorates her life and her work. Oh, we've got that picture, by the way, on the Central Times show page on WPR.org. Can you tell us about the quote that's inscribed on it? Waste is not waste until it is wasted.
Right. That was one of many pithy sayings Millie had. That was the root of her philosophy. You know, she grew up during the Depression. She grew up on a farm in Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl years. When she was a kid, they made or grew almost every single thing that they used or consumed. And so she understood that it's a waste if you throw something away. But just because it doesn't do what it was originally meant to do, if you can find a way to reuse it or recycle it, it's not wasted.
She sounds like an incredible person, and we're going to give Millie the last word. Here she is from that same interview in 2012, 2 years before she died.
My folks always said, use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without.
The voice of Millie Zanto. And Elise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Elise Moser, the author of What Millie Did, the Remarkable Pioneer of Plastics Recycling. 2016 is on track to be the hottest year on record, possibly replacing 2015, which up to last year was not only the warmest year, but it also broke all previous records by the largest margin to date.
This past year brought other troubling climate news, record thinning of ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland, large-scale bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef, and record low ice on the Great Lakes.
Pinning down the root cause of these climate events is no simple task, as a combination of man-made and natural events could all play a role.
Galen McKinley is with us now. She's professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and affiliate faculty in the Center for Climatic Research at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Galen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, warmest year on record, likely to be there. How much of this is climate change and how much of this is what I've heard is an El Nino year?
Right. So it definitely is, has been an El Nino year. It's been one of the strongest El Ninos since 1998. But there's definitely also evidence of that climate trend in there. So if we look at how much warmer 1998 was than the average, the long-term average, it was about 0.6 degrees warmer than the long-term average. And that was an El Nino plus some climate change. Well, now with an El Nino that's certainly no stronger than the 1998, we're at about 0.94 degrees warmer than that same long-term average number. So there's definitely a component of that. And if we look at 2016 being this warmest year, it's the third year in a row that has been the warmest year. And if we look at all the past history, which are the most warm years, that's 1998 and then another 6 years since 2005. So it's very clear we have a trend.
And another milestone, I understand, has been reached, the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. We crossed a threshold that for years scientists have been hoping to avoid.
Yes, we're now at permanently above 400 parts per million, which was reached in September, which is usually the lowest, the dip in the lowest part of the seasonal cycle in atmospheric CO2 because of the summer growing season that has taken up carbon out of the atmosphere. But since that low point was above 400, now we're quite sure that we're essentially permanently above 400 at this point.
And now it's a round number. What is the significance, though, of being, at this level of carbon dioxide?
Well, nothing really. It is a bit more symbolic. Every year we add about two or three parts per million to the atmosphere in the recent years. This year we added a bit less carbon than in past years, which is a good thing, but it's a bit of a symbolic threshold. There's no effect on the climate that is, a tipping point at 400 or something.
But staying higher is bad in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the Paris Agreement that made the goal of not getting above 2 degrees C, that was the goal. Presently, from January to November of this year, we're at 0.94 degrees C globally, average, above the long-term mean. So that means we're halfway to that 2 degrees, and the more carbon we put in the atmosphere, the closer we get.
It seems like not that long ago we were talking about seeing the impact of climate change on the Earth down the road in decades at the end of the century. Are we seeing it now?
Well, if you look at the Arctic right now, there are parts of the Arctic that in November were 20 degrees Celsius warmer than average, which that's 36 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average. So this is a really dramatic warm year in the Arctic and really dramatic low in the sea ice. They are 27% below the average, the long-term average. And the last El Nino was right at that long-term average in 98. So we've had a huge decline. We're about half the summer sea ice in the Arctic than we had in the 70s. So lots of big trends. And also the other thing that has been observed is the Antarctic sea ice has declined, which has been not what we've seen in the past few years, but we see a clear decline in that. And in the U.S., if we look at all the states in the union, about 6 states have had the warmest year on record through November, and all the other states have been in the top 5 with only one exception. So it's really everywhere, this warming trend.
Now, with the decline of sea ice, as I understand it, one worry is that You're changing maybe the salinity level of parts of the ocean. You're kind of rolling the dice on currents that shape what our climate is, the weather we feel year after year.
Yeah, I mean, it's very true that if you look at a map and you look in the North Atlantic, for example, you look at the latitude of England and the Netherlands and Sweden and Norway, those are the same latitudes where we have Labrador and Greenland on the other side, the western side of that basin. And the reason Northern Europe is, you know, habitable and comfortable for a lot of people to live is because we have this big transport of heat in the ocean and the atmosphere that preferentially distributes heat from kind of the middle latitudes to those higher 70 degree latitudes in Europe. And that those circulation systems are definitely affected by the overturning circulation of the ocean, which requires the North Atlantic to get dense enough in the winter to sink down and to pull water to the north, essentially, in a general sense. If we cap that with fresh water from the, particularly from Greenland melting or enhanced precipitation, we might slow down that circulation.
A big worry about the impact of climate change has been sea levels. Now, when we're talking about sea ice, that being there or not doesn't really affect the sea level. What are we seeing with ice that's on land in Antarctica, in the glaciers of the world, that could actually increase sea levels?
Yeah, we are seeing record melting, and increasingly, if we look at the last 10 years or so, we see more evidence that the rate of sea level rise is being driven not just by more heat in the ocean, which certainly we know that warm water takes up less space, so that's definitely one effect, but over the years, more and more of the sea level rise is being driven by the melting of the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica. And also some of the science that we're finding out about how stable Greenland in particular is, how likely is it that that ice sheet was fully gone in other warm periods in the last million years. We're increasingly learning that that ice sheet really might have been almost fully melted in for several hundred thousand years within the last million based on geologic evidence. And that would be about 20 meters of sea level rise.
20 meters.
Well, maybe it's only, let me think about this. It's probably more like 20 feet. I might have my units wrong, and I know units matter. So at least 20 feet. It's still huge, right?
Good difference.
Yeah.
Talking to Galen McKinley, professor of atmospheric and oceanic studies at at UW-Madison, looking at the impact of climate change in 2016. We also mentioned the Great Barrier Reef and a bleaching there. What's the link between that and climate change?
Well, so the reason that corals would bleach the primary reason is because of warming. When they get too warm, they essentially expel some of the algae that is held in those calcium carbonate structures that they create. And if you have a warm year and there's some bleaching, in theory, those they can then reacquire that algae and continue in future years, but there can be also some permanent loss and permanent death of these corals. So there's some natural cycling there. But what we're seeing right now on the Great Barrier Reef, particularly the northern part, which is closer to the equator, is just a massive bleaching and death of the corals, like none other. And it used to be thought that the northern Great Barrier Reef was more pristine because there were basically less humans there. And that was, you know, the pristine part of the reef. But now it's far worse affected, and that's because of the warmer oceans. And part of that warmth is probably associated with that El Nino, but it's also because of these long-term trends. So it's a combined effect. And there's really a lot of concern about the long-term health of the Great Barrier Reef, which is, you know, just this incredible wonder of the world. Of course, you know, our total effect on the coral reefs are also human pollution and other more local effects, but definitely the global warming. And then the other part of the global warming effect on the reefs is ocean acidification. So the ocean has taken up about 40% of all the carbon we've put in the atmosphere, but that take up of carbon, which while it slows our global warming, it also lowers the pH of the ocean. So that is not good for those calcium carbonate structures of the corals as well.
Over the course of the last couple of years, we've seen some pretty extreme drought events in the United States and in some other places in the world. I know it's hard sometimes to have a smoking gun. This extreme weather event is directly linked to global warming. But does it stack the deck against us, global warming? Does it make these events more likely?
Right. So when we think about extreme events, the weather, there are always extreme events in the weather. And so you can think of sort of a distribution of on any, you know, there might be some very warm days, might be some very cold days. But if we shift the mean, that distribution shifts towards warmer. And so the likelihood of getting those warm events becomes more likely, even though there's still some bouncing back and forth. But you're going to get to those very warm events more likely. And that's what the science shows us. And there's actually increasing evidence that heat waves and drought have the probability of them happening is significantly being enhanced by global warming, and whether that's heat waves in China or in India or the kind of drought that we're experiencing in the Southwest.
Anti-climate change efforts like the Paris Agreement signed last year may be in question now. Do you see any good news out there in the effort to reduce atmospheric carbon and cut down some of the damage?
Yeah, I mean, so just in the last month, in November, November 4th, 2016, the Paris Agreement did come into force because there were 55 countries, or 55% of the emissions, enough countries to make 55% of the emissions, had signed on to that and had ratified the treaty. So that is now in force. And now we have 118 countries that have signed on to that, which is 80% of the total emissions. So, you know, even if the U.S. doesn't live up to their agreement that they have also signed under the new administration, the rest of the world is really taking this seriously, as the science indicates that they should. And the Paris Agreement is a really big step forward that we should be hopeful for. And it really encourages everybody to make their effort to cut their emissions and to move the economy and the fossil fuel, reduce our fossil fuel use and bring ourselves into a more sustainable way of interacting with the Earth's environment.
Galen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Galen McKinley, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences and affiliate faculty in the Center for Climatic Research of the UW's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies.
Coming up, before President-elect Trump enters the White House, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has sent a list of requests for returning more power to the states. We'll learn more about that in just a bit. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling on the Moth Radio Hour. Among tonight's stories, rookie reporter Lewis Lapham learns a lot about the world when he has to break some bad news to a new widow. And boxer Jose Torres defines and then conquers fear. Tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, in fewer than 30 days, Donald Trump will be sworn in as President of the United States. In advance of President-elect Trump's inauguration, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has submitted a letter this week calling for the new Republican president to yield some federal power back to the states.
In the letter, Walker asks for more say in how and when refugees are settled in states like Wisconsin. He also calls on the future president to allow states to have more authority on issues like welfare reform and hunting federally protected animals like wolves.
Susan Johnson joins us now. She is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Susan, in broad strokes, how would you characterize this letter and what Governor Walker is asking for?
Well, I think the letter is a political document, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean that in the sense that the governor is trying to get some broad goals laid out there, so not so much necessarily in regard to each of these policies that he goes through, but he begins with this lesson, I would say, on the appropriate role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states, and talks a bit about federalism and the erosion of, in his mind, state power as it relates to the federal government's power. And it's something to put out there for public consumption. I guess it's important to understand, not so much that it was meant for Donald Trump to then begin ticking off on day one which of these particular items he was going to address.
In the opening lines of the letter, he calls for the federal government to be returned to a small, centralized body, he says, as the nation's founders intended. This has been a debate really throughout the nation's history, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's one of those things that when you teach political science, that you talk about the recurring themes that come back over and over again. And absolutely, this idea of the appropriate role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states is something that was part of the founding documents and comes up continually over our American history.
Has President-elect Trump given any indication that this is something that he's behind, ceding more of that federal power back to the states?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at some of the things that Donald Trump has spoken about in regards to different types of policies, both economic policies and social policies, he's been, I would say, fairly consistent in the idea of the kinds of responsibilities that have maybe more historically been state responsibilities, being willing to consider that. And that's definitely something that is a core belief of the Republican Party today.
And looking at some particulars, Governor Walker mentioned flexibility on welfare reform. One of his hopes is to get a waiver to allow some level of drug testing of public assistance recipients. We've seen calls, I don't think this is in this letter in particular, but of federal block grants for health care, transportation, other items where, you know, federal money might come in with fewer strings attached. Is that the kind of thing we might see more of from a Republican Congress and a Republican president to sign off on it?
Well, right. I would think so. And when we have Republican Congress, we have the majority of governors being Republican, and we have a president, the president-elect, being Republican. I would think that we are going to see more calls from states, particularly those led by Republican governors. But to be fair, every governor, regardless of his or her political stripes, would like to be more powerful. And you even hear Democrats sometimes speaking about federal government mandates, although it's more likely to be heard from the Republicans. But I would expect that this is going to be something that we're going to hear consistently moving forward. It's not just Governor Walker and President-elect Trump, but it's also Speaker Ryan, who has been quite vocal in regards to, you mentioned health care and talking about block grants and things like that.
And Republicans have said for a long time during the Obama administration that the federal government became more powerful during this time, that there was overreach at the federal level and the states got less power and the federal government stepped on its toes, on their toes. Is there truth to that claim?
I would say, and I think that generally speaking, this becomes a partisan issue, that both sides will argue that the president of the opposing party has taken on more administrative authority. And it's interesting because when President Obama ran for office, he talked about the overreach that his predecessor, George W. Bush, had taken in a number of ways. And what we see historically when we look at presidencies, particularly presidencies where you have a Congress that is dominated by the other party, is that when a president wants to enact policy change, and he has few options doing it legislatively, you're often going to see the president act administratively. And so when President Obama had a Democratic minority in both houses in Congress, then what he had to do if he wanted to enact change was to do so administratively. What that does is it allows you to enact limited change, so it's not the same kind of change. It's not the long-lasting change that you can get by doing something through the legislative process, but it does allow you to enact policies when otherwise you wouldn't be able to.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, looking at state-federal government relations, Governor Walker sent a letter to President-elect Trump this week asking for more flexibility, more authority at the state level on a list of items. And Susan, I remember when Tommy Thompson was governor of Wisconsin, the phrase states are the laboratories of democracy used to float around, the idea being that with flexibility, without too many federal restrictions on what they do, states can come up with great new ideas, innovate, and then share those ideas with other states. On the positive side of state flexibility, is there something to that?
Oh, sure. And if we think about welfare reform, and speaking of Governor Thompson, mm-hmm. the first thing that comes to my mind in that regard is the W-2 program and the idea that that became a model almost, and so for the nation. And so there became this idea that that states, it wasn't just with Tommy Thompson, but broadly, again, when we teach about federalism and the like, we speak about states being laboratories of democracy where and policy where ideas come up maybe more organically, and they're a way to try things out. I can also think of what we now know as Obamacare began as Romney Care in Massachusetts. If we recall, that was the health care reform law that was passed in Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was governor, that then is very similar to what the Affordable Care Act became years later.
How might that power shift to the states, the flexibility you were just talking about, affect states when you're looking at an era where there's more model legislation that might be enacted in a number of states at the same time?
That's an interesting question. And I would think that when you have more consistency across states, because there are organizations that provide model legislation, I would think that it would even spur more, I guess, experimentation or more states getting on board with similar sorts of policies, which might then have more momentum moving up to the federal level to enact federal legislative change.
Now, on the negative side, people hear the phrase states' rights and think back to the Civil War. I mean, states without federal oversight allowed people to be sold, owned. After that, of course, states' rights was used as an excuse to prevent mostly African Americans from being able to vote and obtain other civil rights. Talk about the downside, potentially, of more authority going to states.
Well, I think that one of the things that people who advocate for having more national policy would argue is that it creates a greater likelihood of equality across states and for people within individual states who would not be subject to laws that perhaps would be discriminatory, as one example, building on what you spoke of. And also when you have policies that exist at the state level, you end up having a lot of difference, and that can create problems in and of itself. So, I mean, a lot of this has to do with what types of policies we're speaking about. And again, I keep going back to that idea that both parties speak to mandates, speak to these issues of states' rights and when the federal government is overreaching. And you really have to look at these things policy area by policy area, and then parse out where the partisanship is kind of woven through there.
Susan, I want to dig into the issues in the letter right now, and I want to start with the issue of refugee resettlement. It's an issue that's probably gotten the most attention from news organizations. What was Governor Walker asking for to Donald Trump in this letter?
In the letter, he asked that the federal government give the state of Wisconsin and states in general a greater role in determining the number of refugees a state receives, and in general, not just speaking of some of the groups we've been talking about recently, but which countries that we accept refugees from. There weren't a lot of specifics in the letter about, you know, point by point what he was asking for, but that's the broad idea that he was speaking about.
Susan Johnson is with us right now. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and we're talking about the balance of power between the states and the federal government after Governor Walker sent a letter to President-elect Donald Trump asking for more state authority on a variety of issues.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the letter, the specific request the governor had on refugee resettlement, a hunting of gray wolves, drug testing for people receiving public assistance, and on the broader issues, how much authority do you think states should have as compared to the federal government on those and other issues? Do you think that the federal government has gotten too much authority now, or do you worry about the rise of more states' rights? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation now about states' rights and the federal government. After Governor Walker sent a letter to President-elect Trump asking for states to have more authority in dealing with concerns, including refugee resettlement and welfare reform.
And we'd like you to join the conversation. What do you think about Governor Walker's call for more state authority? What role do you think the federal government could and should play under the Trump administration? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Susan Johnson stays with us. She's assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. One issue not in that letter, but we could see a state-federal showdown. States, not including Wisconsin, Susan, have allowed the legal sale of marijuana, medical or even recreational. The attorney general nominee, Jeff Sessions, not a fan of marijuana. People are saying there's a chance that the non-enforcement of federal law in those states, well, that could go away. We could see big changes in pro-marijuana states.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just talking about that, in fact, today with one of my colleagues, because someone mentioned that that seemed like it's settled and the federal government has, you know, turned a blind eye. And to a certain degree, that's true, but that's very dependent on who's sitting in the White House and maybe even more importantly, who's sitting in the Attorney General seat. And Jeff Sessions has been quite vocal historically in his not supporting legalized marijuana. And that's one of those situations where it really rests on the prerogative of what the federal government wants to do, because we had a series of states, even in just this past election, that legalized marijuana either medicinally or otherwise. And states have done that, municipalities have done that. But should the federal government determine that it is going to enforce the laws that are on the books regarding marijuana, then they could shut a lot of that stuff down. It's an interesting question. I'm curious to see how this unfolds.
Another area that came up in the letter was air quality. It sounds like Governor Walker asking to remove some rules about emissions. What did you see there?
Well, I think that that's fairly consistent with what we've seen from Governor Walker and I would say Republican governors and Republicans in general in terms of the issues of regulation as they relate not only to air quality and air pollution, but also to things like drilling and the pipeline issue that's been going on in Wisconsin, but also in other places, the Keystone Pipeline, what was going on in the Dakotas. And so I think that what we're going to be seeing are big pushes in that area to deregulate as it relates to environmental laws.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ken is on the line with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, I was just going to say about, I hear so much about state rights, and now when you have these model legislative groups like an ALEC, it's almost as if they function as a quasi-federal government. When you see the same legislation coming up, sometimes out of nowhere, and it's always something that's in front of three, four, five state houses, it really makes me concerned that this is being done in, you know, back doors, but as a nationally coordinated thing. And so that's the first point I make. Second point I make is some of the state right things can lead to a race to the bottom, say environmentally. You know, if state next to you is passing easier environmental laws and you're losing business because of those, that forces you into a position where you have to do the same thing. So from that perspective, I see federal legislation better because it applies for a fair playing field across the board.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, let's take that second point first. That's interesting. The federal government could be setting a bar for states to avoid that kind of race to the bottom that Ken was talking about.
I think that perhaps Governor Walker or Republicans, if we're talking about environmental legislation, might turn that on its head, though, and say that overregulation is what harms business and economic interests, and what the caller might think is a race to the bottom in regard to environmental protections, someone on the other side might argue is an effort that would hurt a state in terms of its economic development. So I think we, you know, if we're considering it from both sides, that's, I think, something to keep in mind.
And what about the caller's comments about model legislation acting as what he called a quasi-federal government?
Well, I think that's interesting. I don't know if it's a quasi-federal government, although I understand the point that he's making, that when you have a national interest group, essentially, in the case of ALEC, developing this model legislation and then encouraging legislators from different states to introduce that, you almost are having somewhat national policy being made, but it's still being made at the state level.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. We'll go next to Casey with us in Madison. Casey, hi.
Hi. My concern is that as states become very different from one another, if we have a lot of variety in state laws, we're going to have people who self-select where they live. For instance, I moved to Madison in 1995. Today, I would never move to Wisconsin. I would not have taken a job here. I would never move to North Carolina right now, no matter what kind of a job was offered to me. As more and more people who are able to self-select where they live move from state to state, depending on the individual state laws, are we going to find ourselves in a situation where there's more polarity than we already have in this country?
Casey, thanks for that call. And Susan, demographers have talked about a big sort going on already where we're voluntarily moving in with people more like us, politically, ethnically, economically, you name it. Is there a chance you think this could accelerate that kind of polarization?
Well, I mean, like you said, demographers are showing that we're seeing this happen. So I think that people are doing this self-selection, and especially people who are able to move. And so you have people who are able to take jobs in other places, move their families, and relocate. And definitely people are going where they see a policy environment that is perhaps more an economic environment, a policy environment that's more attuned to their beliefs. And so I think that that's definitely something to keep in mind. But I think it's a trend that we've already seen happening.
Casey, thanks a lot for the call. And we go next to David in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. I was calling in because I was concerned about adding a lot more power to the states, because I see that's what it slowly slips away to. Immigration and policies of people coming in the country, that's a broad country kind of aspect, I believe. Back in the 1860s, we fought a civil war because there was this struggle that was going on between the states and federal government, and we sort of settled it out at that point, saying yes, the central government, the U.S. government is central to that. So as these other aspects that you talk about, I have a real concern that outside groups, interest groups, will influence more and more, because it's easier at a smaller level to do that. So I'm just not in favor of that.
David, thank you for that. And what do you say to David's concerns about outside groups having more luck influencing from the state level rather than getting a toehold at the federal level?
Well, sure. And if you look at policy change over the course of, let's say, the last decade or so, what we've seen is that states, and I would say particularly the Republicans, have been very, very, very successful in electorally and in terms of public policy, winning elections and enacting public policy at the state level that aligns with their goals. And so I would say that there's been a lot of policy change and that we could talk about that Republicans have been very successful in enacting at the state level, and that would be one of the reasons why the governor is sending a letter to the president-elect, because in a state like Wisconsin, where control of the legislature and the governorship is both of the same party, there would be a goal to enact more policy at the state level.
And we have to leave it there, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She was with us to talk about the letter Governor Walker sent to President-elect Trump requesting states have more authority over laws and issues.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll explore the selected letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
For Food Friday, we go for something sweet and learn about how to get the most out of cooking with honey.
That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow, Joy and her guests take a look at President-elect Donald Trump's $1 trillion infrastructure plan. It's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then a new report finds that inflation and healthcare costs have slowed significantly since the Affordable Care Act came along. We'll get the details. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.